Hear now the words.
Greetings. I am Publius, and you, I suppose you know who you are listening to a long-form spoken word presentation on AnonRadio.net.
And this is the 15th of February. And once again, I am calling in live with a reading from various sources that I have here on my desk. You would be surprised just how much reading material there truly is here on the desk. But the last live reading I did, I read from The Cole Question by Jevons from 1866 or so. And I was going to start reading from Nuclear Power Magazine, subtitle The Journal of British Nuclear Engineering. I've read a couple of excerpts from that on previous shows, mostly last year. Anyway, and I couldn't find the thing that I wanted, and that was because I was looking in the wrong place for it. It turns out it was actually the first place I looked. I was just not looking at it correctly. So I'm going to read to you the editorial, which begins Nuclear Power, Volume 2, Number 9, January 1957. I think the individual issues are numbered sequentially or something. It's a little confusing. Anyway, where am I? Okay, so yes, this is the editorial entitled A Light Through the Gloom. Highlighted by the onset of oil rationing and the general political gloom, the first stage of Britain's nuclear power program began to take on an aspect of urgent reality last month with the awards of three huge contracts for power stations. Harking back to the much-quoted white paper of February 1955, this foresaw the construction of two 50 to 100 megawatt stations, starting construction mid-1957, followed by two more at the turn of 1958-59. This would mean 400 to 800 megawatts in operation by 1963. In fact, what is now projected, taking into account the Inkley Point station, which has not yet been finally approved, is at least 1,150 megawatts net output to be available about the turn of 1961-62. This is a wonderful achievement, and one which surpasses the white paper planner's wildest dreams. Not only is the output much greater, the time scale has been drastically condensed. How it has been done is obvious only in general terms. It will need time to study the designs in order to find out what solid engineering advances have been made. Nevertheless, it is already clear that these new projects represent a tremendous advance in reactor technology, and one which reflects great credit on the firms which have poured so much money and effort into producing practical designs in such a short time after starting absolutely from scratch. As for the next step, the expected revised program, the country still awaits Mr. Jones' pronouncement, and it is to be hoped that it will be based on the idea that we must build to the limits of what is physically possible. This is literally the only way in which we can survive in the long run. The new program must obviously be based on a bird's-eye view of the whole industrial scene, but it should be flexible enough to meet changing circumstances. In other words, we do not want a new plan every 2 years or so. If the master plan is well drawn, it should be able to survive as an entity until it is fulfilled. Limitations there will be, the shortage of steels, graphite, and other materials, but they must be foreseen and plans laid now for overcoming them. Manufacturing capacity for a large proportion of the program is not likely to be a bottleneck, for it must be remembered that the nuclear stations will be replacing conventional stations. Although the latter will continue to be built for some years, they will form an ever-decreasing volume of work which will release labor and plant for the rapidly developing nuclear program. And that very much seemed to resonate with me after reading Jivan's on the coal question. We must build to the limits of what is physically possible. This is literally the only way in which we can survive in the long run. You look at the actual results of the first British nuclear power program, even after it was curtailed. You look at the actual results of the French PWR program. And if you're anything like me, you begin to feel some hope for our world, which sometimes seems hard to locate. Anyway, let's see. So yes, facing this editorial is one of the most remarkable advertisements I have ever seen in my life. It's a photograph from behind of a toddler, a small child, wearing your typical small child garment, standing on some grass at the margin of a pond or stream or something. There are some birds, etc. And at the top of the page, it says, in quotation marks, it's, "Therefore choose life." Underneath that, the same quotation slightly more extended, "I have set before you life and good, death and evil, therefore choose life." And then further on says, "No more crucial choice was ever presented to men than the use to which they put the unimaginable power of the atom. The same raw material can be made to produce electric power for the business of peace, or bombs capable of destroying great cities in a blinding moment. The companies whose names appear here are not the arbiters in this matter. They are contractors concerned with the peaceful development of atomic energy. Indeed, they have just been instructed to build a nuclear power station for the Central Electricity Authority on the Severn Estuary. These companies form a skilled team of artificers in a new industry of immeasurable importance to this country and the world. As Britain becomes laced with threads of ever cheaper and more plentiful electricity, they will turn their attention elsewhere so that industrial development springing from the use of nuclear power may bless the lean places of the earth. The power for creation now in our hands is beyond the dreams of a generation ago." I think that's one of the most remarkable advertisements that I've ever encountered anywhere. What other things do I want to read while I'm here? Now, I have this very interesting book, Continuing the Nuclear Dialogue by Alvin M. Weinberg. Now, these are essays from Dr. Weinberg, one of the great pioneers and exponents of nuclear energy, even though, he is known for a certain amount of pessimism. For example, coining the phrase Faustian bargain, which he defends here. I'll read you. So his paper, his essay, The Moral Imperatives of Nuclear Energy, I'll read you the introduction to it. It really is an interesting essay. But he says, "This paper, which was a memorial to Jack Chernick, was given at the Bal Harbour, Florida meeting of the American Nuclear Society in October 1971. Many of the same ideas were contained in my Rutherford Centennial Lecture at the annual meeting of the American Association for the Advancement of Science in December of that same year, which was published in Science, Volume 177, page 27, 1972, under the title Social Institutions and Nuclear Energy. I think I may have a copy of that issue of Science. I think I may have bought that. Anyway. It was in these lectures that I first used the expression Faustian compact or Faustian bargain to connote the dilemma that mankind faced in opting for nuclear energy. The phrase Faustian bargain has been used very widely, mostly by anti-technologists as well as anti-nuclear activists, but I do not regret having referred to nuclear energy as a Faustian bargain. All of our modern technologies, as Lothar Nordheim once pointed out to me, are burdened to a degree with the same dilemma. In exchange for evident good, like providing food for India, they require a higher degree of care and surveillance than was the case when societies were less complex and less crowded and the technologies less pervasive." The following essay was written before Rasmussen had completed his analysis of the probabilities and consequences of serious reactor accidents. The estimates I gave for an accident, 10 to the minus 8 to 10 to the minus 5 per reactor year, are to be compared with Rasmussen's 5 times 10 to the minus 5 for a meltdown with an uncertainty of about 10. Nevertheless, one must recognize that at the time, within the nuclear community, the possibility of an accident was not viewed as the central problem of nuclear energy. Of course, Three Mile Island has drastically changed that view. So I may have that essay. I may read it at some point. But, so this Weinberg book is certainly very interesting. You know, his 1971 essay, Nuclear Energy, A Prelude to H.G. Wells' Dream, from Foreign Affairs, April 1971. And I'll read you his introduction to that, actually. During the 1960s, my optimism about the possibilities of nuclear energy reached its peak. I was much influenced by R.P. Hammond's observation that, because capital costs scaled, that is, the cost per unit of capacity diminishes with increased size, the high unit capital cost of nuclear plants could be reduced if the plants were large enough. At present, at least in the United States, most energy economists would reject this principle. They would point out that as the size of an energy-producing unit increases, its reliability tends to diminish. The optimum size is therefore less than the now standard 1,000 megawatts. Whether in the long run such a limit on size really exists remains to be seen. In the Soviet Union, for example, reactors larger than 2,000 megawatts are now being contemplated. I am not prepared to concede that the last word has been said on the question of size scaling. Certainly very, very high reliabilities have been achieved with nuclear generating units of 1,000, 1,100, 1,300, 1,400, 1,500 megawatts. I think these energy economists were arguing before the results were really in on the basis of some very limited information. Anyway, he says, if capital costs do eventually turn out to scale, then we may once again look forward to low-cost energy from very large nuclear power plants, and the idea of desalting the sea or producing hydrogen with nuclear energy would have to be taken seriously. At present, with survival of nuclear power at any cost being the issue, even to raise again the possibility that nuclear energy will eventually prove to be very cheap seems indeed like a Wellsian dream, but the returns are by no means all in. By 2000, if the reactors now online work well, the pendulum may once more swing toward H.G. Wells' vision. Also, his 1959 paper, Energy as an Ultimate Raw Material, or Problems of Burning the Sea and Burning the Rocks. I'll read you the introduction for that as well. He says, "This paper probably has influenced my thinking on nuclear energy more than any other I have written. The basic question is this. Since the amount of uranium available at an economically tolerable cost is limited, perhaps 20 times 10 to the 6 power tons, and a 1,000 megawatt light water reactor uses about 4,000 tons during its 30-year lifetime, a nuclear era consisting of only 5,000 reactors would end after about 50 years. Was the development of nuclear energy worth the trouble and expense if it were only to achieve such a limited goal? In the early days, we had more or less implicitly decided that this limited goal was insufficient. We considered the breeder to be the real aim of nuclear development, but we had not really tried to estimate how large an energy source the breeder represented. Since the breeder used uranium 60 times more efficiently than did light water reactors, it was usually assumed that the breeder extended our resource by a factor of 60, but this error, which is often repeated even today, overlooks the far larger importance of the breeder. It makes available the vast low-grade uranium ores that cannot be used in light water reactors because the energy required for recovery of the uranium would be less than the energy produced from burning the uranium. This paper points out that the breeder, no less than fusion, is in principle an inexhaustible energy source, and that therefore the breeder is and remains a goal of transcendent importance." Harrison Brown, from whose speculations about net energy derivable from the rocks I drew heavily, deserves great credit for his insights on these matters. The issue had been raised as early as 1943 by Philip Morrison at the Metallurgical Laboratory. He concluded at the time that uranium from granites could be used in breeders and that the energy balance was positive. Brown's asymptotic energy input of 63 terawatt years per year, of which 16 terawatt years per year is solar, would be regarded as very high by current fashion in energy futurology. For example, the International Institute for Applied Systems Analysis study, Energy in a Finite World, projects a world in 2030, that is, 75 years from 1954, the date of Brown's projection, of between 18 and 26 terawatt years per year. But Brown's distribution among the various ultimate sources of energy is quite consistent with my own current views of the long run. Again, I come out as a technological optimist. There is no doubt that I have underestimated the difficulty of achieving a commercial breeder, certainly one based on liquid fuels. Nevertheless, I remain convinced to this day that learning how to burn the rocks, safely and economically, remains one of mankind's most important technological challenges and the underlying justification for support for nuclear development. The talk on which this essay was based, it was presented before a meeting in New Orleans at the Southeastern section of the American Physical Society on 10th April 1959, and was reprinted in Physics Today, Volume 12, Number 11, page 18, also 1959. So, between 18 and 26 terawatt years per year by 2030. Well, let me see if I can do the math very rapidly for you. So, world energy production in 2018, according to the International Energy Agency, was 14,421 million tons of oil equivalent. So, 14,421. Now, what do I multiply? There must be some multiplication factor I can use to get million tons of oil equivalent. It's a horrible unit. But I think... methodology, is that it? Yeah, okay. So, to convert million tons of oil equivalent to something even vaguely useful... okay, so that is... Okay, I can either convert to terajoules or gigawatt hours. Neither one is any better than the other, I guess. But so million tons of oil equivalent to gigawatt hours. From million tons of oil equivalent to gigawatt hours, 1.163 times 10 to the 4 power. All right. So, times 1.163 10 to the 4th is 167,716,230 gigawatt hours divided by 8,760 hours in a year, 19,145, so that's 19 terawatt years. Okay, so that is the low end of what Hayfola projected for, I'm sorry, IIASA, which is heavily associated with the German nuclear scientist Wolf Hayfola. Anyway, so what Hayfola projected for 2030 at the low end. So it looks like Hayfola's idea is probably, more related to what we're actually seeing happen in the world today. Well, that's useful to know. It also tells us that if we wanted to supply all the energy for the world, we would need, let's see, 19,000 1-gigawatt nuclear reactors working all around the clock. That's actually not really unachievable. So that's an interesting thought, isn't it? I really need to go through this these volumes of nuclear power again and make some better notes as to what's worth reading, because there's a lot of interesting stuff in these editorials, for example, and as I say, in the advertisements and various other places. Here we have, so for example, their article on the Dune Ray fast reactor, and it says, what the DFR will do. Britain already knows how to make 1 ton of uranium metal do the work of 10,000 tons of coal in the new nuclear power stations now being built for the Central Electricity Authority. This sounds a lot, but actually it is not a very efficient utilization of nuclear fuel, and Harwell scientists have now proved that it should be possible to increase this by 100 times. We can thus hope eventually to extract from 1 ton of uranium the energy that would be produced in burning 1 million tons of coal. It is to find out just how to do this that the Dune Ray fast reactor is being built. The DFR, in fact, is a colossal engineering experiment, and though it will produce some power, its main object is to pave the way for a new type of power station which we shall be building about 1970. Well, that proved over-optimistic. They were building the PFR about 1970, and they never actually did get to CFR, the commercial fast reactor. The principle behind it is this. It has been found that all reactors, in addition to consuming nuclear fuel, actually create some. In the Calder-Hall type of reactor, the amount produced is less than that consumed, but by a special arrangement of the fuel, it has been proved that a type of reactor can be built which will actually produce more than it burns. These are called breeder reactors. This may seem a violation of some fundamental law of nature, but it is not so. All matter contains nuclear energy, but so far we know how to release it only in a very few rare materials, like uranium-235. It has been found, however, that certain common materials, such as ordinary uranium and thorium, can be made into what are called fissionable materials and used as atomic fuel. Further, this can be done as a by-process in a nuclear reactor. Thus, we are not creating a new energy source, but merely providing a key to obtain energy that was there all the time, but inaccessible to us. Reactors that breed fissionable material are also called fast reactors, not because they produce power at a rapid rate, but because the neutrons which cause the nuclear disintegrations or fissions travel at a very high speed. In a reactor of the Calder-Hall type, the neutrons are slowed down deliberately in a graphite moderator to quite low speeds for a neutron, and these are called thermal reactors because the neutron speed is merely that corresponding to the temperature of the material in which they are traveling. In the fast breeder, we want to keep the neutrons as fast as possible, and so have a small core of highly enriched atomic fuel, actually uranium-235, in which nearly all the heat is generated, and no moderator at all. At Dune Ray, the core is only 21 inches high and 21 inches across, yet from this, 15,000 kilowatts of power are obtained. The core is surrounded by ordinary uranium rods, like the kind used at Calder Hall. In this breeder blanket, as it is called, uranium atoms are converted, by neutrons escaping from the core, into another atomic fuel, plutonium. After a time, this fuel can be extracted and used in other reactors. Fast reactors are not competitive, but complementary to thermal reactors. An integrated cycle might consist of a number of thermal reactors using mostly natural uranium, with a little plutonium. These would produce some plutonium, which would be extracted and sent to the fast reactor for use as fuel. The breeding process would produce even more plutonium, which would then go back to the thermal reactors for enriching them. This, however, is some way ahead, because a satisfactory way of using plutonium on a large scale has not yet been worked out. That, I think, is just about as compendious and comprehensive an explanation as one could ask for, even though I can't read the lovely diagrams over the radio. A slightly longer explanation of the same phenomenon. Oh well, tried to send some metadata and glitched it. Anyway. In a thermal fast fission, its possibilities, its problems. This is under the headline, The Physics Behind the Engineering. In a thermal reactor, a moderator is used to slow the neutrons down so that a majority of fissions take place at thermal energies. In the case of a reactor using U-235, along with considerable quantities of U-238, natural uranium for instance, it is only possible to make a chain reaction self-sustaining on thermal fission. This is because U-238 is only fissionable by high-energy neutrons, greater than 1.1 million electron volts, and the inelastic scattering cross-section of U-238 is the dominant cross-section at high energies, about 60% of the total. Thus, the fast neutrons produced on fission have only a very small chance of producing another fission. Suppose, however, that instead of moderating the neutrons to thermal energy, one removes either part or all of the offending U-238. Uranium-235 is fissionable at all neutron energies, and it is then possible, if sufficient U-238 is removed, to sustain a chain reaction on fast neutrons only. In this case, no moderator is used, so that the neutron energy is kept as high as possible, say, greater than 0.1 mega electron volt. Now, in a thermal reactor using, for example, natural uranium, the fissionable U-235 is continually being used up. But because of the inevitable resonance and thermal neutron capture in U-238, Pu-239 is being continuously produced. Plutonium-239 is like U-235 in that it is fissionable at all neutron energies. In a typical natural uranium thermal reactor, approximately 0.8 Pu-239 atoms are produced for each U-235 atom destroyed, and so for each U-235 atom destroyed, in effect, only 0.2 fissionable atoms are used up. This naturally raises the question whether it is possible to replace all the U-235 by Pu-239, or even to produce more Pu-239 than the U-235 used up. However, it can easily be seen that this is not possible in a moderated reactor. Consider the number of neutrons produced per neutron absorbed in U-235. For thermal fission, this figure is 2.08. But of these 2.08 neutrons, one is required to carry on the reaction, and only 1.08 are available for all the other possible losses. These are capture in U-238 to form Pu-239, capture in the moderator and other materials, and loss by escape from the reactor. So capture of one of the 1.08 neutrons would leave only 0.08 for the remaining losses, an impossibly low figure. A similar situation exists for thermal fission in Pu-239, where the number of neutrons produced per neutron absorbed is 2.07, and so again it would not be possible using, say, Pu-239 and U-238 to produce as much Pu-239 by capture in U-238 as is used up by fission and capture. However, for U-233, the neutron yield on thermal fission is 2.29, and so it is possible that, by using a mixture of U-233 and thorium, more U-233 could be produced from the thorium than is used up. Now, the possibility of producing more fissionable material in a reactor than is used up becomes a much more feasible proposition when reactors working on fast fission only, fast reactors, are considered. The neutrons produced per neutron absorbed for fast neutrons, about 2 mega electron volts energy, for U-235, U-233, and Pu-239, are respectively 2.3, 2.4, and 2.6, so the possibility of achieving a gain factor greater than zero is good. This gain factor is defined as the number of new fissionable atoms produced per fissionable atom destroyed minus unity, and so represents the net gain in fissionable material. As stated above, one of the requirements for a fast reactor is that the neutron energy must be kept as high as possible, so that the fissions take place at the highest possible energies. This is necessary because as the neutron energy decreases, the fraction of neutrons captured in the fissionable material increases, so that figures for neutrons produced per neutron absorbed decrease. This means that it is important in a fast reactor to limit the amount of material in the core, which will appreciably slow down neutrons. In practice, then, as far as possible, low-mass elements must be excluded from the core, and so the coolant and structural materials must have as high an atomic weight as possible and yet still perform their primary functions efficiently. A further feature of fast reactors is the high power density of the core. For example, comparing a fast and thermal reactor using only U-235, the critical mass of U-235 in the fast reactor is much greater than the critical mass of U-235 in the thermal reactor for the same heat output. This is because of the low fission cross-section at high energies. However, the size of the fast reactor core will be smaller than that of the thermal reactor core because of the absence of the moderator. So, for a given power output, the fast reactor core is very much smaller than the thermal reactor core. This means that the cooling of the fast reactor has to be done by a very efficient coolant, and liquid metal coolants are favored because of their good heat transfer properties. Sodium, or sodium-potassium alloy, are possible coolants, and they also satisfy the nuclear requirement in that they are not very good slowing down media. A further consequence of the cooling problem is that, because of the large amount of heat to be removed per unit volume of core, the fuel must present as large a surface as possible to the coolant. This means, for example, that if fuel rods or tubes are used, they must be very thin or thin-walled, so there must be very many of them. The general arrangement of a fast reactor is, then, a core containing the fissionable material in the form of rods or tubes, surrounded by the fertile material. The material which captures neutrons to produce fissionable material is usually referred to as the fertile material. This blanket of fertile material captures neutrons as they escape from the core, but it also serves as a reflector insofar as it scatters some of them back into the core. Because it consists of heavy atoms, it does not appreciably reduce the neutron energy on scattering, and so its action is different from that of the reflector in a thermal reactor. Compared with the operation of a thermal reactor, there are certain differences with fast reactors. The problem of fission product poisoning hardly arises because the absorption cross-sections are so low. Temperature effects still occur, and negative temperature coefficients can be achieved. However, the temperature coefficient arises mainly from density changes in the reactor components, and not from cross-section changes with neutron energy as in a thermal reactor. The neutron lifetime is much shorter in a fast reactor, and this means that a given power increase occurs much more rapidly in a fast reactor. Also, the actual method of control is different, again because of the low absorption cross-sections at high energies. This means that control rods are not very efficient, and so control may be affected by moving a fuel rod or by moving part of a blanket. Moving a control rod in a thermal reactor alters the neutron absorption, and moving a fuel rod in a fast reactor will also alter the absorption. Moving part of the blanket has a similar effect because it will alter the number of neutrons escaping from the core, and so again effectively alter the absorption. Because of the short neutron lifetime, control has to be affected rapidly in a fast reactor. This raises the point that if the control was not sufficiently rapid, the power could rise so rapidly that the fissionable material could melt and perhaps collect in a sufficient quantity to form a dangerous mass. Thus, a fast reactor must be so designed to obviate these difficulties in exactly the same way as it is designed to have a negative temperature coefficient. A further consideration is in the choice of fissionable and fertile materials. Initially, as at Dunray, the fissionable material might be U-235 with a U-238 blanket to produce PU-239. However, the PU-239 produced can then be used for further fast reactors, and ultimately systems using PU-239 and U-238 used to eliminate entirely the necessity of producing U-235 in a diffusion plant. And for my usual editorial commentary, I will say that one might indeed regard a breeder reactor as a equivalent to a isotope separation plant for the production of fissile material, only with a negative power consumption, which is rather attractive, to be perfectly honest. And I don't think that I've seen the economics of it looked at in quite that way. Negative power consumption and a negative tails fraction, which is nifty too. In other words, a mixture of a fertile material goes in and a mixture of fissile and fertile material comes out. The fissile content out being greater than the fissile feed in. Anyway, and now I think I'm just going to read a paper entitled Importance of Isotopes in Technology and Industry from the 1955 Geneva Conference Proceedings. By P.C. Abersold of the U.S. Atomic Energy Commission. Radioisotopes are exceedingly abundant and widely useful byproducts of nuclear reactors. They are a peaceful development of atomic energy that is already bringing rich benefits to humanity. Reactor radioisotopes have now been distributed extensively for 9 years, and their use has grown rapidly, yet they are still far from attaining their vast worldwide potential for gaining new knowledge and improving health and welfare. As has been true for other nuclear developments, the concepts, discoveries, and instrumentation which have led to the production and use of radioisotopes have been international. It is not necessary here to review the long and important role of radioactivity in science, medicine, and industry, or how it has been the key to all nuclear discovery, from the discovery of radioactivity itself to the nuclear atom and eventually to uranium fission. It is interesting to note, however, that the one element, uranium, has had both a singular and rejuvenated role as a source of radioactivity. Uranium first brought to man's attention in 1896 the phenomenon of radioactivity, in itself a form of nuclear energy, although not then recognized as such. Now, almost 60 years later, it provides, by means of the uranium chain reaction, a tremendous source of both useful energy and a broad array of new radioactive species. Uranium, source of many useful natural radioisotopes, has thus also become, through the reactor, the major source of the more numerous and widely applicable man-made radioisotopes. Since the discoveries and inventions basic to production and use of radioisotopes have been international and are well known to technical persons, they need not be referred to here. The published works related to radioisotopes, including characteristics, production, measurement, techniques, radiological safety, and utilization in all fields of application, constitute an enormous worldwide literature. It would be almost impossible to give proper credit for or even to list major publications pertinent to all developments or topics discussed in this broad survey paper. Literature references will thus not be attempted. Furthermore, in presenting statistics on distribution or illustrations of usefulness, it has been necessary to refer to the program and experience in the USA. This is because of greater familiarity with that program and is not due to lack of recognition of extensive distribution by several countries such as Canada, Great Britain, France, and Norway, and use by over 50 nations throughout the world. Since most uses discussed in this paper are in technology and industry, they will, of course, have more application for nations with greater technological development. The basic principles of use may, however, be applied to special problems of many nations. Uses in science, agriculture, and medicine will, of course, have universal application. No single measure can be given for evaluating the importance of tools of research and application so variedly and extensively used as isotopes. The endeavor to summarize the importance in this paper will be made on the basis of the following. 1. Great inherent power of isotopes in tracer or indicator techniques. 2. Tremendous range in intensity and radiation energy of radioisotope sources. 3. Rapid growth in utilization. 4. Wide applicability of basic principles of use. 5. Specific illustrations of usefulness in various fields. 6. Present and potential value of uses. 7. Significance of isotope techniques and applications in the overall development of peaceful use of atomic energy. Power of isotopes as tracers. The sensitivity of the isotope tracer technique depends on detection of the isotopic label after dilution with other atoms of the same element. Dilution with atoms of dissimilar elements can usually be eliminated, if necessary, by chemical separations. If a stable isotope with a natural abundance of about 1%, such as carbon-13, were concentrated to 100% abundance, it could be diluted only about 104 times with normal carbon and still be detected. This is, of course, suitable for some experiments, but is a serious limitation for many. A stable isotope with a higher natural abundance would have a smaller limit of possible dilution. Deuterium, with a natural abundance of only 0.015% and obtainable almost isotopically pure, presents a most favorable stable isotope tracer. In this case, using a mass spectrometer, a dilution with normal hydrogen by almost 10 to the 6 power times is detectable, although with difficulty. The dilution attainable with a radioactive tracer depends on available activity per gram of the element, efficiency of the detector, and reliability of detection above the natural radiation background. For example, carrier-free or 100% phosphorus-32 has an activity about 2.9 times 10 to the 5th power curies per gram, or 6.4 times 10 to the 17th power disintegrations per minute per gram. With ordinary Geiger counter methods, one can readily detect less than 20 counts per minute above background, or around 10 to the minus 16th power grams of phosphorus-32. If the sample is diluted with stable phosphorus, self-absorption will reduce the amount detectable. However, self-absorption is greatly reduced and counting efficiency increased by new methods where the radiomaterial is placed inside a liquid scintillation medium or gas counter. Using latest low-level counting techniques, in which the natural background is minimized by shielding and anti-coincidence methods, it is possible to measure radioisotope samples containing only a few disintegrations per minute per gram. For carrier-free phosphorus-32, this would, in theory, permit a dilution with ordinary phosphorus of about 10 to the 17th power. Even if this dilution is theoretical, it is obvious that phosphorus-32 can be readily detected after tremendous dilution. Many other useful isotopes, such as iodine-131, have a very high carrier-free activity and can be detected with comparable sensitivity. In case the element has a radioactive isotope in nature, as for example, hydrogen-3 and carbon-14, this activity becomes an inescapable part of the natural background for this element. For living or biosphere carbon, the activity is about 13 disintegrations per minute per gram, whereas for carrier-free carbon-14, the activity is about 10 to the 13th power disintegrations per minute per gram. Theoretically, therefore, C14 could be traced after dilution in living carbon almost a million times. Tritium has an activity about 2 times 10 to the 16th power disintegrations per minute per gram, and its natural specific activity is extremely minute. Consequently, it can be traced through an even greater dilution than carbon-14. Such sensitivities of detection are millions of times greater than for any other means. In addition, the isotopic labeling technique can be unquestionably specific. An isotope of an element is chemically identical with the element except for a small isotope effect in chemical reactions affected by difference in isotope mass. The isotope effect is demonstrated by altered reaction rates, but not by a qualitative difference in mechanism of reaction. A difference in reaction rates is considerable only for isotopes of great mass difference, such as those of hydrogen, but is demonstrable for isotopes of carbon. The effect can be taken into account, however, when it affects quantitative experiments. Matter of fact, decades later, the French did develop a process for chemically separating the isotopes of uranium, but it is rather time-consuming and involved. Several criteria must be met for an isotope to serve as a perfect tracer. The dose of radiation or amount of chemical added must not affect the reaction studied. Also, the isotopic label must be in the proper chemical state or affixed in the proper molecular location. These criteria, however, are in general readily satisfied. Available counting techniques permit almost any tracer experiment to be accomplished with amounts of radioactivity very much less than might affect the system. To avoid adding chemically toxic amounts of the tracer, it is often necessary to have very high specific activity material. Radioisotopes made by transmutation or fission are obtainable almost carrier-free, hence specific activity is generally no problem. Radioisotopes produced by neutron absorption may have to be irradiated in a high-flux reactor to meet this criteria. Reactors with fluxes in the range of 10 to the 13th to 10 to the 14th power neutrons per square centimeter per second produce sufficiently high specific activity in even the most toxic elements. Techniques of multiple labeling with isotopes provide additional means of achieving specificity in tracer experiments. Different portions of a molecule can be labeled simultaneously with two or more isotopes. Double or even triple labeling of organic compounds is accomplished with such isotopes as hydrogen-2, hydrogen-3, carbon-13, carbon-14, nitrogen-15, phosphorus-32, and sulfur-35. Such labeling permits simultaneously tracing individual portions of a complex molecule, thereby checking molecular decomposition as well as eliminating the question of exact reproducibility of experiments. It is usually possible to identify positively a radioactive isotope by its radiation and/or half-life. With proportional or scintillation counters and pulse height discrimination circuits, it is often possible to use several radio tracers simultaneously in an experiment and count them separately without chemical separation. Further, with such discrimination equipment, it is possible to do accurate neutron activation analysis. The material to be analyzed is irradiated in a reactor, and the induced radioactivities are differentiated. This technique can identify parts per million or even million million of certain elements. The method has limitations, however. A high flux of neutrons is required. The unknown element must be suitably activated, and too many radioisotopes with similar radiation characteristics must not be produced simultaneously. Other special, powerful analytical procedures are possible with radioisotopes. Mention should be made of various types of isotopic dilution techniques. An isotope labeled compound of known isotopic ratio may first be added to a system containing the unlabeled compound. Then, after thorough mixing, an isotopic analysis of the altered ratio for an unknown portion of the total gives the dilution of the isotope label and thereby a quantitative measurement of the total amount of the compound originally present. This technique is useful when the system is very large or the compound cannot be quantitatively extracted. A similar isotope technique is used to determine the success of chemical purification. The desired pure compound is properly synthesized with a radioisotope label. This is then mixed homogeneously with the compound being purified and the specific activity determined. If, after repeated purifications, the specific activity of the compound remains constant, maximum purification has been achieved with the procedure. Use of this technique, along with chromatographic, electrophoresis, and low and ion exchange separations, reveals constituents below conventional criteria of chemical purity. Autoradiography should also be noted as a sensitive and detailed detection for radioisotopes. It uses a photographic emulsion to obtain a picture of the distribution of radioactivity, for example, detailed location of radiomaterial in tissues or cells or in grain structure of metals. With fine-grained nuclear emulsions, resolution can be achieved down to about 5 microns. A new high-resolution wet-process autoradiography uses a very thin layer of sensitized silver bromide capable of giving resolution down to 1 micron. Although this is far from the resolution obtained with good microscopes, when combined with the tracer technique, it provides information not obtainable in other ways. Great versatility is possible in the labeling of materials with isotopes. Useful radioisotope tracers can be produced for most elements. Fortunately, for those elements having radioisotopes with half-lives too short for tracer work, such as nitrogen and oxygen, one can use concentrated stable isotopes, nitrogen-15 and oxygen-18. In a few cases, such as fluorine and copper, however, stable isotope tracing is not feasible, and the radioisotope also has a limited half-life. Aluminium was in the latter category, but recently a long-lived isotope, aluminium-26, has been produced by cyclotron bombardment of magnesium, and although available only in low yield, may provide a tracer for this important element. The overall situation for tracing elements is thus most fortunate. Fortunately also, most of the important radio tracers can be made with a reactor. Further, methods have been devised for synthesizing a large number of isotope-labeled compounds, either by chemical or biological means. Over 1,000 labeled compounds are now readily available. These include biochemicals, pharmaceuticals, and industrial chemicals. Techniques have also been devised for labeling a wide variety of organisms, such as blood cells, bacteria, viruses, and higher organisms. Fabricated materials, such as piston rings and machine tools, can be activated directly by irradiation in the reactor. The total result is a very large number of elements, compounds, materials, and organisms which have been made radioactive for tracer studies. The radio tracer technique thus has the combined power of tremendous sensitivity, unquestioned specificity, and wide versatility. Such a great extension of power of observation supports the prediction that isotopes may become a scientific tool as routinely and widely necessary as a microscope. Wide scope of radiation sources. In addition to use as tracers, radioisotopes have another broad and important category of application as sources of radiation. For this use, chemical identity is not the major interest, but rather the character and output of radiation of the radioisotope. Here also, radioisotopes are very versatile. They provide alpha, beta, gamma, and in some cases, X-ray sources. Also, by secondary means, they may provide X-ray and neutron sources. The range of available radiation energies and half-lives is broad enough to cover requirements for a large variety of practical uses. Reactors provide radioisotopes in far greater intensities and at a much lower cost than do natural sources or particle accelerators. The tremendous production capacity of the reactor, while very desirable to produce isotopes even for tracer uses, is absolutely essential for wide-scale application of radioisotopes as radiation sources. For example, the activity of gamma-ray emitting isotopes now used in radiography totals thousands of curies, and for teletherapy of cancer, the ultimate use will total hundreds of thousands of curies. Large-scale sterilization of foods and drugs would require millions of curies. The only reactor-produced alpha-ray emitter now used widely in industry is polonium-210. It is not only useful as an alpha source, as in self-luminous compounds and static eliminators, but is extensively used with beryllium for neutron sources. Reactor production far surpasses the normal supplies of natural polonium and at much less cost. Polonium-beryllium sources containing 50 curies or more per source are readily available. The yield of neutrons averages about 2.3 times 10 to the 6th power neutrons per second per curie. Many polonium-beryllium neutron sources are used for neutron logging of oil wells and other techniques which depend on neutron reflection from hydrogenous material. Other alpha-ray emitters, such as plutonium-239, can be produced by reactors. Some of these would have certain advantages over polonium, particularly in longer half-life, but their applications as sources await further development. Table 1 is a list of some important, because of large production or number of uses, reactor-produced pure beta-ray emitters. Many others are available, but those listed cover beta-ray energies from 19 kilo electron volts for tritium to 2.24 million electron volts for the yttrium-90 daughter of strontium-90. The half-lives also have a range from 14.3 days for phosphorus-32 to about 5,700 years for carbon-14. The isotopes from hydrogen-3 to calcium-45 are all routinely produced by transmutation and have very high specific activity. They also constitute isotopes of body elements and accordingly are widely used in biology and medicine. Strontium-90 is extracted from uranium fission wastes, and thallium-204 is produced by reactor irradiation of thallium. These two beta emitters find wide industrial use at present because of the combination of long life and energetic radiation. For some industrial applications, however, the low-energy beta rays of hydrogen-3 are useful. Because tritium can be produced cheaply, it is comparatively safe to handle and has a desirable half-life, it should come into extensive industrial use. Table 2 is a list of currently important gamma-ray emitters, which are producible in high intensities and large activities by the reactor. Other gamma-ray emitters, especially those from fission products, can be produced cheaply in quantity and may in time become important gamma sources. Rarely do radioisotopes emit only gamma rays without beta rays. However, for most uses, the beta rays are inconsequential or can be filtered out. Iron-55 is an isotope with no beta rays, which as the result of K-electron capture gives soft manganese X-rays that have special applications. The gamma ray energies in Table 2 range from 0.084 million electron volts for thulium-170, to 2.6 MeV for sodium-24. For biological and medical purposes, including therapy, the short-lived isotopes such as sodium-24, iodine-131, and gold-198 are extremely useful. Cobalt-60 and cesium-137 find much industrial use because of their long life and high energy radiation. Thulium-170 is useful for its very low-energy gamma ray, but its half-life of 127 days calls for frequent source replacement. It should be noted that beta rays can excite X-rays, Bremsstrahlung, and that low-intensity X-ray sources can be obtained from high-intensity beta ray sources. Lack of long-lived low-energy gamma-emitting isotopes has prompted the development of such beta ray-excited X-ray sources. These sources can have a long life, and the wide range of energy spectra, consequently many industrial applications can be expected. The wide interest in cobalt-60 makes appropriate some remarks about its production. It is routinely produced with many times more gamma-ray output per gram than radium. For radiography, cobalt-60 with a specific activity of 1 to 10 curies per gram is excellent, whereas for teletherapy units, material of 50 curies per gram or higher is desired. A 1,000 curie cobalt-60 source has been produced with a specific activity of about 100 curies per gram, about 10% of the stable cobalt having been converted to cobalt-60. Canadian and USA reactors are now scheduled to produce over 100,000 curies per year of high specific activity cobalt. It would be feasible to produce over 10 times this activity of cobalt-60 per year, especially at lower specific activity. Very great amounts of fission products have already been produced as byproducts of plutonium production, and tremendous amounts will result as reactors are increasingly used for power. Because of this, much attention has been given to development and uses of fission product sources. Of greatest present industrial interest are cesium-137 for gamma sources and strontium-90 for beta sources. This is mainly because of their long useful lives. Other fission products also will no doubt become useful in large quantity if they can be obtained economically. Anyway, you've been listening to me, Publius, on anonradio.net. Send your cards and letters to Box 1035, Fort Worth, Texas, United States of America, zip code 76101.